So last time we saw how we could use path integrals to study theories that were free. In other words, theories where the action, and we were working in imaginary time or Euclidean time, was at most quadratic in the position of the particle. So we studied an action of the form, integral over time, 1/2 m q dot squared of tau plus 1/2 m omega squared q squared of tau. In other words, a particle in a harmonic potential. Now, in general, we're interested in quantum mechanics of particles moving in more general potentials, where the action is not necessarily quadratic in the position. And, well, we saw last time that when it's quadratic, the path integral for the propagator So we constructed this expression for the path integral form of the propagator, and this was just a bunch of once we discretize this is just a bunch of Gaussian integrals that you can do as long as this action is quadratic. Most general case, the action is not quadratic. We might have a new term in the action, and for example, just for concreteness, we might add a q to the fourth term. So this is some particle here in a quartic potential. So if we add this new term, q to the fourth, then once we discretize the propagator, it will be a product not of Gaussian integrals, but of integrals like e to the minus some quartic function, which is not a function we know how to integrate in general, closed form. So in order to do this integral, we need to find a way to approximate this integral, and we're going to construct a series expansion in this parameter lambda. So we're going to assume this is some small parameter. Here's a small parameter, and we can construct a series expansion. So there's a question. Good morning, Dario and Pavlo. So here, if we're working in real time, in physical time, then there is an I in the exponent. We are, like we did last time, we're going to work in imaginary time. So there's a minus sign in the exponent. And I'll make a few comments about what changes, but one reason why we're working in imaginary time is that the math is a little bit easier if everything is real. There are other reasons as well. We discussed some last time, and we'll discuss again next time. Okay, so this is the integral we want to approximate when S is something that's not quadratic in the positions. For example, we have a quartic term. And one way to do that is this discretization we did last time. We construct this by discretizing the path. And so we can compare this integral, the integral we're trying to compute, versus this toy integral, which we can think of as one of the integrals in that discretization. So if we understand each of the integrals in that discretization, that will tell us about how to construct a full path integral. We take the limit or the n, the number of intermediate points that we're integrating over, goes to infinity. So let's compare this integral we're interested in versus this one-dimensional integral. Which is just one of those integrals in the discretization. You can also think about it as just a toy model for this integral. This, as we'll see, this ordinary integral shares many of the properties of this full path integral. And so there's an analogy to keep in mind between this one-dimensional integral and this path integral, which is like an infinite dimensional integral, that limit n goes to infinity. So here, just to be explicit, the analogy is that this integral ke is like I, and q of tau is like x. So that's our integration variable in the case of the integral I, or function in the case of the path integral q. And in the exponent, we have se on one side and f on the other side. And so let's pause for a minute and think about how we would approximate the integral I. And that will tell us, suggests an integration an approximation scheme for this integral ke. So let's imagine that f is some function that has a minimum at zero and does something else away from zero. So in that case, if f is a real function that has this form, well, then the most important region in this integral is the region where f is smallest, which is near this minimum at x equals zero. So the smaller f is, the bigger the integrand is. So some region around this minimum will be the most important contribution to I. Just by thinking about what the integrand is doing as we look at the sketch of f, that tells us that, well, a natural approximation scheme is just to, instead of trying to compute the whole integral, let's try to manipulate the integrand into some form we can integrate in this region near the minimum, and then use that to approximate the value of I. That's what we'll do. So we need to look in this one-dimensional case at the minima, so where f prime is zero, and f double prime is positive. And the same argument basically applies over here. If we look at the path integral expression for the propagator, the action is going to be real if if we take this look at this expression in the top line, it's a function of q. So q is a real variable, that's a real function. So here we've got this exponential is an exponential of a real functional. And so because of the minus sign, the integrand will be largest when the action is smallest. So we want to, again, look at regions where the action is minimized. So that's it would mean that the variation of s, when we do a small variation, the path should be zero. And we should have some conditions, which I won't write out carefully, that make sure that we're at a minimum instead of a saddle point or a maximum. So I'll just write that as s double prime is greater than zero. This is not, I haven't written this out carefully because, well, here. But schematically, we just need to check. Also that it's a, the points where we're approximating this integral, or the regions where we're approximating are minima, rather than maxima or saddles. Okay, and so we want to look at approximate our integral near regions where near the minima, and I'm going to call the minima in this case xc, and in the other case we'll call them classical trajectories qc of tau. And the reason I'll call these classical trajectories is because this condition here, that the variation of s with respect to q is zero, is the equation of motion. This is the equation of motion. So the classical trajectories are the most important in this approximation scheme. And one way to think about why that's the case is that this approximation scheme is closely connected to the semi-classical approximation, or the classical approximation and corrections to the classical limit. So there's a question about what conditions. Yes, the equation of motion doesn't have any conditions on the second derivative of the action. So here, this will be, they could be maxima. So here, in this approximation scheme, we're looking at a subset of the solutions to the equations of motion. So we need to check that we're including the correct ones. And over here, if our sketch F had local maxima as well, we wouldn't want to necessarily include those in our approximation. The reason that this approximation scheme is connected to the classical limit is that as we take h bar to zero, the F over H bar become more and more peaked. So if this is a sketch of, I've drawn a sketch here of F, the exponent is e to the minus F over H bar. As H bar gets smaller, the relative importance of points that are away from this minimum becomes less and less. In other words, if I change this plot to F over H bar, as H bar gets smaller, this plot will get spikier and spikier. So as H bar goes to zero, it will become some spikier and spikier if this is a smaller value of H bar, and the approximation where we just include the region near the minimum will be better and better. So this scheme that I'm just describing, and we'll flesh out later in the lecture and in the breakout rooms, is the semi-classical approximation. And we'll see later that actually there's a connection. We can think about our expansion parameter as either h bar or this small parameter in our action that describes how far we are away from a free theory. That's something we'll discuss after the break. Okay, so if we want to ask what paths we're considering in this approximation, so we have some classical path QC of tau, and the important paths will be the paths that are close to this. So paths that are close to this will be nearby and then therefore have an action that's close to the action of the classical path. So our approximation will include close to the classical paths. And so, so far, very little of what I've said depends on the fact that we are in imaginary time instead of real time. So if we go back and look at the statements I made before. So if we add back this I instead of this minus sign, so that would be what happens when we're in real time. Well, what would change? So this analogy would still work essentially the same. We could still consider a toy version where we had an I in the exponent. And what would be different? Well, is that the regions in I that are important would be the regions where the phase of the integrand is approximately constant. In other words, the regions near where f prime is zero. So far that's this condition. So that part is the same. What would change would be this condition. So we'd have some other condition about which of the solutions to f prime or zero are relevant, and that is one aspect where having the minus sign instead of the I makes things easier. So if we do have the I, it's a more subtle mathematical question about which of those solutions to f prime equals zero contribute. So that's one difference, and at the level of the discussion we're having right now, that's essentially the main difference. So is this question of which of the solutions is trickier in that case. But otherwise, our discussion goes through essentially unchanged. Okay, so given this discussion, our strategy for approximating I or approximating K, which will be the same, will be to first Taylor expand F around its minimum value. That's the region that's most important. And then we want to manipulate the integral we get there into a form that we can integrate. And so it turns out that if we write I as in a form like this. So after you Taylor expand and after some algebraic manipulation, you can turn the Taylor expanded integral into a form like this. So here C1 and C2 are some constants. N is the parameter that determines what order you've Taylor expanded to, or it's related to that at least. And so in the breakout rooms, you'll show that after the Taylor expansion, you can manipulate it to this form. And this form of the integral, it's like a Gaussian integral, except we have this monomial multiplying the integrand. And that's a form of the integral that can be done. And I just want to sketch how to do this type of integral. It's a useful method that is used in physics and the path integral formulation and in generalizations to quantum field theory frequently. And that's to consider what happens if you consider a free theory with a classical source. So we're going to add a source J. This is a classical source. And so if we consider the free propagator with a classical source, then our path integral, let me go to the next slide. Okay, so with a source, the propagator becomes exponential of minus one over h bar, zero d tau, 1/2 m q dot squared tau, so just the free, just the three theory so far. But what we're going to add here is a source, classical source, j of tau, q of tau. And the reason I'm calling it a classical source is it's some function we're not integrating over. So the integration is where the quantum mechanics is coming in. As we argued, quantum mechanically, all possible paths should contribute. Here, J is just some function we're inserting by hand. So it does affect the action and therefore the motion of the particle because we're changing the action. This function J is coupled to the trajectory, so it changes the action and will change the dynamics. But it's not something we're integrating over. So this is a classical source. And with our analogy, we can do the same thing. We can take our free version of the one-dimensional integral, which is just a integral that has a quadratic term, and add here an x times some number j. And so the reason that this is a useful thing to do is, well, this is still a Gaussian integral. This is still an integral we can do exactly. And what we'll see is we can relate this free theory. It's a different free theory than the one we considered before because we have this classical source. It's still a free theory. We can relate this free theory to the approximation we're making to our interacting theory, which will give us integrals of this form or we've got this extra x to the n multiplying the integrand. And so just to sketch how it works, and we'll explore this some more in the breakout rooms, well, let's just look at the toy example, the one-dimensional integral. So if we know that this integral, this can be done. This is just a Gaussian integral. This is root pi e to the j squared over 4. And we can take a derivative of this equation. On the left side, this gives the derivative with respect to j brings down a x, which is what we want. And on the right-hand side, the derivative with respect to j brings down a j over 2. And then we can set j equals to 0 to get integral dx, x exponential minus x squared equals 0, which is not the most interesting result because, we could do the integral x e to the minus x squared just using symmetry. That's an odd integrand if we integrate over an even integral, we know it's 0. But if we do more derivatives, we can get interesting results. So the integral x squared e to the minus x squared is an integral we can do. Diana asks why we're deriving with respect to j. The reason we're deriving with respect to j is because we want to compute integrals that are like x to the n e to the minus x squared. So as you're going to show in the breakout rooms in just a few minutes, after you Taylor expand the exponential, to Taylor expand the argument of the exponential, you can manipulate the resulting integral to take this form, where it's a sum of integrals, each of which is x to the n multiplying in e to the minus x squared. So if we can evaluate those integrals, then we can approximate the integral we're ultimately interested in. Okay. So this technique allows us to do that. Okay. And you'll explore how to generalize this for in the breakout room. And one thing you'll use is you'll look at exponentials of derivatives. If this is not something you've seen before, we have an exponential of a derivative. That's defined just by the Taylor series of the exponential. So this is like 1 plus dj plus 1 half d squared dj squared, etc. So it's like the Taylor expansion of e to the x, but where we set x to be a derivative. So that's, you'll see that that's a useful thing to do when you apply this. Okay, so we're gonna go to breakout rooms now, and I'd like to have a somewhat longer discussion than usual at the end. So we'll see in your discussion in the breakout rooms, you'll see some new things. So you're going to construct perturbation theory using the techniques I've outlined, so you can fill in some of the details. And you also see why you look at how and why perturbation theory can fail. So that's something you will one of the last problems there in the folder. It has some discussion there, and I'd like to spend about the last 20 minutes of class discussing the problems in the breakout room and further directions. So we'll go to breakout rooms now, and I will call you out somewhat earlier than usual. All right, I think everyone is back now. Okay, so I want to discuss some key points from the problems we just looked at. So the first question is looking at the semi-classical limit. And the integral we're looking at is this integral e to the minus x over h bar. And the first thing we can do is Taylor expand f around its minimum. Which we'll call xc. And if we're Taylor expanding around the minimum, there's no linear term in the Taylor series. So the first correction is the second order term. And you have higher order terms. So we know how to do Gaussian integrals. So these higher order terms are the problem. And the way we can proceed is we can Taylor expand these higher order terms. So these higher order terms you can write as 1 plus f triple prime over 3 factorial h bar minus xc cubed, then there'll be higher order terms. We can get this squared. We could also get fourth derivative and so on. So once we Taylor expand that part of the exponential, we're left with Gaussian times a polynomial, and we can do each term in that. And in order to figure out the h-bar dependence, so we have some h-bar dependence already. There's also an h-bar in the exponent. To get the h-bar out of the exponent, you can do a change of variables. You know, let y equal x minus xc over the square root of h-bar. Then this integral will be like integral minus infinity dy e to the minus f yc the e to the minus 1 over h bar f of xc comes out, and we have the e to the 1 half f double prime of xc y squared. So there's no h bar dependence here, and we'll get an extra h star dependence from each term depending on how many powers of x minus xc are there. So it'll be y cubed h bar to the 3 half over h bar. It'll be a y to the fourth with some coefficient, h bar squared over h bar, and so on.
n, excuse me. I think you also have a power of h bar from the measure.
Yes, I do. Should be a root h bar here. And so this looks like it'd be the leading correction, except this term here, except this integral is odd. So this term integrates to zero. And so our leading correction has one extra power of h bar compared to the term before. And another thing we notice from this construction is that the coefficients here will be related to the parameter lambda we had before, minus the exponent. Thank you. And we should be minus two, probably. If we compare, so our derivatives, if we have at a quartic term, say the fourth derivative will just be coupling lambda. And so this coefficient here will be lambda. And if we tail expand our exponential to higher order, we'll get a F4 squared over H bar. So the power of lambda is connected to the power of h bar through this Taylor series. Exactly what the connection will look like will depend on what choice of theory we have, but because lambda will be connect our coupling, our small parameter will be connected to the derivatives, and the derivatives always show up with certain powers of h bar. There's the semi-classical expansion is also an expansion in how close our theory is to being free. So that's something else we see in this construction. And there's a question. Okay, that's the minus the next one. Okay. Okay, so in the second problem, you look at this and do this construction explicitly for the toy example where we've got a quartic in the exponent. And just sketch that derivation and point out what goes wrong. So looking at an quartic interaction. So the integral we're interested in computing is this one. And using the methods we discussed earlier with a source, we can compute this exactly. But essentially one of the first things we do is we'll Taylor expand this exponential. The exponential of the quartic term and get some j equals zero to infinity minus lambda to the fourth to the j over j factorial. And to make any further progress using the techniques we've discussed, the next thing we have to do here is swap the sum and the integral to write this as sum j equals zero to infinity integral dx minus lambda to the j for j factorial x to the 4j e to the minus x squared. Now, swapping a sum and integral is like changing the order that we're adding up terms in a series. Integration is like summation. You can discretize an integral and it literally is summation in the limit. And well, sometimes it's okay to change the order of terms in a series. Series is absolutely convergent, and it doesn't matter what order you put the terms in the series. But other series are conditionally convergent, or if they may oscillate, and if you change the order that you sum the terms in the series, you can change the result. So changing the order of summation is something that's only sometimes allowed. So we've changed the order of summation here, and that's something to potentially be concerned about. And as you show in the problem, in fact, if we do this, swap this summation, then we can proceed and evaluate each term in this sum, and the resulting series ends up diverging. This integral over here converges. If lambda is positive, this is a more convergent integral than the Gaussian. So we get something finite is equal to something divergent because we swapped the sum and the integral. Now, just because our result diverged does not mean this technique is not useful. In fact, this technique or variations of it are behind essentially all of perturbation theory and quantum mechanics and quantum field theory. And in a sense, this is the most successful technique, perturbative technique in calculating anything in all of science. This technique is behind the theoretical predictions of quantum electrodynamics, which is the most precisely tested theory in all of science. Some predictions are tested to 10 or 11 digits and agree with experiments. So that the theoretical calculation uses exactly this technique, swapping the sum and the integral, and working to, I think, fifth order is the state of the art. It works, even though it diverges. It's not nonsense, even though we have had some divergent answers. So I just want to say a few words about how to interpret the right-hand side and why we should expect this kind of result physically. And we'll go into more details about how this works next time. So what we've found is not a convergent series for our original integral, but instead what's known as an asymptotic series. So our result is some series, some coefficients, aj, in our small parameter lambda, or h bar. It works for h bar as well. And what this means is that the limit as lambda or h bar goes to zero of our integral, this is the integral we were trying to compute, minus the partial sum, where we just take n terms instead of the full series. If we divide this by lambda to the n, this is zero for all n. So what this equation is saying in words is that if we take we truncate our series, take a finite number of terms, and compare that to our original integral in the limit lambda goes to zero, that truncated series is a good becomes a better approximation rather quickly as lambda goes to zero to our original integral. So our integral necessarily becomes a better approximation with a fixed number of terms as lambda gets closer to zero. This equation says nothing about whether our approximation becomes better as n goes to infinity. And as we've seen before, it's often the case that the approximation for fixed lambda becomes worse as n goes to infinity. So our series diverges. But it's typically the case that for small n, this approximation can become very good very quickly. Or just taking n equal 5 for the case of quantum electrodynamics, it works exceedingly well. It's not to say if we took n to a million in quantum electrodynamics, that might be a worse approximation. So for fixed small lambda, it's usually a good approximation. Or small n. Why did we get a divergent series physically? So we're not including everything, and there's some effects that we just can't see using this technique. So in particular, effects that go like e to the minus 1 over lambda, or effects that go like e to the minus 1 over h bar. Those effects are invisible in the type of perturbation technique we've just developed. And there are a number of effects in physics that you know about that have this dependence on parameters, things like quantum tunneling. Those effects are exponentially small, or these energy splitting between the ground state or the two lowest energy states for a system that whose classical minima are degenerate. So quantum mechanically, there'll be some splitting between the we have a double well potential where the two wells are classically exactly at the same energy level. Classically, there's two ground states. Quantum mechanically, there'll be some splitting. That splitting between those two lowest energy states will be exponentially small. And effects that are exponentially small are invisible in perturbation, this type of perturbation theory. So we can't see them. And one way to understand that mathematically is that the limit as lambda goes to zero of e to the minus 1 over lambda to the n for any n is zero. So if we're constructing an asymptotic series, there's no way we could see quantum tunneling or energy splitting between degenerate ground states. We couldn't see that. So we're missing something. And so since we're missing something, our answer from before couldn't be complete. So it couldn't be the right answer. And we'll see that we have to include these effects in order to get to understand the full physics of a system. And we can include these effects using some techniques we'll talk about next time. That's where we're going. I'll stick around for if there are further questions, but that's all I wanted to say today. Thank you.
Thank you, Van.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Question, Dan?
Yes, Terry?
Yeah, so on the previous slide, or maybe it was two ago, if you could just go back a little. Yeah, this okay. One? Yeah, so that AJ there is just shorthand for that whole integral, right?
Yes.
Okay. So we've constructed this asymptotic series, and so you say for a given fixed capital N, it approximates our integral well for very small lambda. but it fails to detect effects like e to the minus one over lambda.
That's right.
Okay. So in practice, what do? We typically take a partial series then where n is just some arbitrary large number? Like if it's true for every n, is there, I suppose it's not uniform. Okay, goodness, this is a hard question to phrase. I suppose it's not uniformly true in the sense that how small lambda has to be in order for it to be a good approximation is still dependent on how large n is, right?
That's right. So one way to phrase this is we could look at the error. So we could look at.
So I guess what I'm asking is there's still merit in taking n very large, because it means that we can get away with larger lambda, right?
So there's two issues with taking n large. One is that in quantum mechanics or in quantum field theory, typically it's harder and harder to get compute the terms with larger n. So for example, the quantum electrodynamics calculation I was alluding to before. So at first order, calculation can be done in an hour. The second order term might take a day. Third order term, I think it took people about 2 years to do the first time. And the fourth and fifth order terms took decades. So,
right.
Despite how much, I mean, often we'd like to go to the higher end, but then it can become very difficult in practice. And so depending on the properties of the series, but in physics, most of the time the series are of the case where the largest n, you can estimate where you expect the best n. So for large n, the approximation gets worse and worse. For small n, it gets better and better. And where it turns around is usually when n is about 1 over lambda. If you know enough about the series, you can show that's the case, but that's very typical. So depending on what lambda you're interested in, you can say whether it's better or worse to go to higher n.
Okay, thank you.